So let's start out with a question which will be reappearing when we look at genetic testing. Currently, the FTC has allowed research software to track internet behavior. Will insurance companies be able to track an insurer's lifestyle habits in order to charge higher premiums? It's an odd way of putting it, because of course you could also offer lower premiums to people with good habits. For example, a person who eats more fast food pays higher medical and life insurance premiums because they are at risk of higher health problems and so forth. As I was saying, the same issue appears in the context of genetic testing. If you can do genetic testing, you can estimate risks. And then the obvious solution in both cases, which has some problems that maybe are not obvious, is not allow the insurance company to use the information. So you can imagine a legal regime, which I think for genetic testing exists, which basically says the insurance company cannot require genetic testing as a condition of insurance, and they can't even, I think, say to customers, if you will show us the results of your genetic testing, we might offer you a better deal. Can anybody see a downside to that in both cases? Because the equivalent here would be having rules saying insurance companies can't use the kind of data being described in the problem, in the question, for setting insurance rates. Does anybody see what the downside of that rule is? Why might you have bad results if you forbid the insurance company from using certain information? Why?
Well, there's I'm not so much of a counter, but I know that they evaluate risk. You have to test how much premium to claim from.
I understand that we can imagine evaluating risk with more or less information. So you could imagine in one limit, suppose the insurance companies, all they know about you is how old you are and whether you're male or female, say. And if that's all they know about you, then they have to charge the same rate to everybody who has everybody of your age and gender. And some people will be overcharged, some undercharged. You might argue that that's in some ways a good thing. It sounds more egalitarian. You, in effect, it's like insurance, where you can insure against being a bad risk. Are there any disadvantages to it? As opposed to an alternative which they have a whole lot of information and can base their premium on that. Yep.
They make assumptions with very little amounts of information.
But they still have information about the whole population. They know on average how likely you are to die if it's life insurance. So why does it matter if they can't distinguish, if you've got two clients, one of whom has a high chance of dying and one of whom a low chance, why is there any problem if they have to offer the same rate to both of them?
Well, you might get poor services across the board.
What do you mean?
If they can't predict, then and those two people are getting the same rate and they're possibly getting the same coverage or services,
yep.
And the person that's sicker probably, if they had a higher rate, a higher rate, but then they might get better treatment, better services, and not have to stay out of pocket.
Think about a case of life insurance where the insurance company isn't making decisions on how much it pays for. It just says, all right, you die, you get X dollars. So would it matter if they do or don't have the information? Any of you familiar with the term adverse selection? Because that's the insurance and also the economics term for the problem that I'm trying to get at. There's no point in trying to pull it out of people. Let's take life insurance. Let's suppose that there is information the insurance company doesn't have, but I do have, about how good a risk I am. And in particular, let's suppose I know that both of my parents died at 106, very healthy, it's not true, unfortunately, I would it were, but suppose I have lots of information indicating that I'm going to live a long and healthy life. And suppose the legal regime says the insurance company cannot use any information like that in setting rates. What is the obvious consequence going to be? I'm charged the same price for health or life insurance as you, who've got all the opposite characteristics. Which of us buys insurance? and I don't. That's adverse selection. Because what's happening is, I would like to be insured at a rate reflecting my risk. The insurance company would like to insure me at a rate reflecting my risk. But if the insurance company can only reflect me at a, only insure me at a rate which reflects the average risk, then although insurance is worth something, it's not worth paying three times its real value, and so we don't get insured. If the effect can be large or small, the effect generally occurs when one party of the transaction has information that the other party doesn't have, relevant to the terms of the transaction. There's a classic article on this subject called The Market for Lemons, where the lemons in question are used cars. And so the case he gives, but it's sort of a simple way of illustrating the problem, is imagine that people are selling used cars and that some of the used cars are lemons and some are cream puffs. Cream puff is a used car that's in much better shape than you would expect from its age, and a lemon is much worse. And imagine just those two kinds to make it easy. The seller knows which it is. He's been driving this car for 5 years. Suppose the buyer has no way of telling. Now, in the real world, you might get a mechanical look at the car, but suppose they're really indistinguishable. And imagine for a moment that from the standpoint of a buyer, a lemon is worth $5,000 and a cream puff is worth $10,000. And to start with, half the cars are each. So you would first say, well, all right, the sellers can charge $7,500. The buyer says 50% chance I'm getting a lemon, 50% chance I'm getting a cream puff. Therefore, I'm willing to pay up to $7,500. We're home free. But the sellers know, and the sellers also value cream puffs more than lemons. So from the standpoint of the seller, if he could get the cream puffs value, get $9,000 or $10,000, he's willing to sell it. But if he's only offered $7,500 for the cream puff, he's not going to sell it. Whereas the guy who's got a lemon, $7,500, isn't that a great deal for getting rid of this car? So what's going to happen is that the cars actually sold will be biased towards lemons. That some cream puff will sell, but most of the cream puffs won't sell, the lemons will. The buyers observe this fact and they say, wait a minute, half the cars out there may be cream puffs, but the very fact that he accepts my offer is evidence that this one is a lemon, so I'd better only offer $5,500. At $5,500, even fewer of the cream puffs go. And in the limiting case, you would end up with a market where all lemons sold at a lemon price and no cream puffs sold, even though the cream puffs are worth more to the buyer than the seller. Right? That's the sort of standard classic example. And you can think about it in the insurance context. One way I like to put it is, imagine I'm selling life insurance. And one day a man comes running into my office and he says, I want $1 million in life insurance right now. All right, I would charge him a very high price for that. He knows something I don't know. All right. But that also means the same fact. The fact that he wants to buy it is, in a sense, evidence I shouldn't sell it to him. We're only at a high price. And that problem is eliminated if we have the same information. If I can say, well, you want to buy it in a hurry because you have just fallen in love and you want to make sure that your wife-to-be and children-to-be are properly taken care of, so I can sell it to you at a good price, whereas she wants to buy it in a hurry because she's just offended a mafia don and expects to be dead within the next 24 hours. Or you can think of cases of that sort. So that's the disadvantage. So that from that standpoint, but let me be fair, the flip side of that is you would like to insure, take the genetic case for a minute. I'd like to be able to insure against the risk of having bad genes, of having genes that make it likely I'll have a heart attack. In a world where we have really good genetic testing, that risk becomes uninsurable because you can't get people to take a gamble after you've rolled the dice. All right, does that make sense? Yes? No? Because this is an issue which runs in a bunch of cases, and most people only see at most one half of it. And the point is that if you don't allow the insurers to use any... If you can keep both sides from having the information, there isn't a problem. Because then you can still insure against whatever the risk is, because you don't know if you're a good risk either. But once one side has the information, now you have the trade-off that if you don't allow the other side to have it, you get some adverse selection, and some good risks can't get insurance because the fact they're trying to buy insurance is evidence they're bad risks and they get charged a bad risk price. Whereas if you do allow the insurance company to use the information, now certain risks that would otherwise have been insurable will become uninsurable because the information is there already. Do people follow the argument? Because it's a little bit complicated, but I think it's moderately important, and it's an issue that comes up in a bunch of different contexts. Yes?
It doesn't break down because the insurance company doesn't have all the information about the potential client. If the potential client doesn't have all the information the insurance company has in what they charge other people, how long they've been in business, all these kind of that. Average rates, typical rates.
So those might be reasons why there could be a problem with the customer choosing an insurance company. But those aren't, I don't think, aside from the possibility the insurance company might go bankrupt and never pay, which is a legitimate sort of separate issue. But in terms of whether to buy insurance, all I have to know is whatever I know about me, plus what terms they're offering me. Right? And that's public information. Now, what is true, of course, is you can imagine a case, and I haven't really thought through the logic, where the insurance company has information about you that you don't have. All right? Suppose that they know how good a risk you are better than you do. And now the fact they want to sell you insurance is evidence that you are a better risk than you thought, so maybe you shouldn't buy it. I would have to think through how adverse selection works in the mirror image case, but I suspect there's an analogous.
But that's also the same place in an area where there's no accidental death, car accidents.
No, of course there is. All that means is if there were no accidents at all, then and the information was available, there'd be no insurance. The point is that in the real world, people differ in their probability distribution for things happening, but not so extremely that one person is sure to have one person has no probability. So the result is, if I'm only a slightly better risk than the average, even if I'm charged an average, I might buy. But the bigger the value of the extra information I have, the more likely it is that I will then choose not to get insured unless the insurance company can give me a good rate because of it. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. Can anybody see a second and unrelated argument for why forbidding insurance companies to engage in what this example says might be a bad thing? Or putting it differently, can you think of any specific advantage to a regime where people who engage in dangerous sports are charged more for life insurance, and people who eat a whole lot of McDonald's food are charged more for health insurance and so forth? That is, where your insurance rate reflects to some degree the effect of choices you make on your risk of having to pay.
Theory can make a safer world.
More precisely, it means, going back to your use of the term efficiency, that you will not be inefficiently unsafe. All right? If I say to myself, yes, I know skydiving is risky, but I'm willing to take that risk. Right? It's a trade-off I make for myself. At least from an economic standpoint, that isn't a problem. You know, we always have costs and benefits. But if I say, well, skydiving is pretty dangerous, but since I've got $1 million of life insurance, so I know that my wife and kids won't have problems if I die, I'm willing to do it. Without the life insurance, I wouldn't. But that $1 million of life insurance was bought at, let us say, a tenth what it should have cost because the insurance company didn't know I did skydiving and I do that. So, therefore, there's a sense in which letting the insurance company distinguish in this way gives you an incentive only to do things that cause costs if it's worth it in terms of costs and benefits to you. All right, make sense? The standard example that people think about in this is auto insurance. Because, of course, auto insurance companies do charge you more if your past driving history is evidence that you're dangerous. They also charge you more if you're a male, whatever it is, 18 to 26. Because, as everybody knows, male humans go crazy at 18 and recover at about 26, as shown by not merely auto accident statistics, but also who enlists for wars, who commits crimes, and a bunch of other stuff. And I think there are evolutionary explanations for this bizarre pattern. But it's not the same effect, because you don't have the choice of not going crazy or not being 18 or 19, so you can pretend not to be. But with regard to things where you're making choices you could make differently, now there is some benefit, and therefore, if we say, if you get speeding tickets, we'll raise your insurance rates, that gives you a greater incentive not to speed. Yeah.
Well, isn't the
I should put a link up on the webpage on that. Progressive insurance company.
Progressive insurance.
Yep.
I mean, of course, there's a lot of privacy issues.
Yes.
Because now they have all this information that they're going to do with it. But
different issue. Yeah, but no, it's an interesting point.
They're kind of walking down this path.
But that one, the two advantages of that are that it gives you an incentive not to drive dangerously. and that it means that if you're a safe driver, they give you a good rate. Now, since auto insurance is compulsory, they're in the adverse selection issue. And in a sense, auto insurance is sort of like health insurance under Obamacare in the sense that it's mandatory. And the argument, basically, the economic argument for the mandate, which of course is the legally controversial part of Obamacare at the moment, is precisely adverse selection. Otherwise, but that if you require insurance, you create adverse selection by limiting the ability of the insurance companies to charge different people different rates. And then, in order to solve that problem, you have a mandate. That's the economics of the arguments for and against that little bit of it, not the legal arguments. But in any case, the point I really wanted to make is not what the right answer is, but that you really do have two advantages to insurance companies having detailed information about you, one in your incentives on what to do, and one in their ability to price in accordance with the information you also have. And that wouldn't apply if you didn't have the information either, which in some of these cases might be true, but it does apply there. Anyway, so that was, makes it, I think, an interesting question. Sort of one that goes along with this. Companies have developed programs that use surveillance-related measures to compile data for use in interest-based advertising. All right, do people understand what they mean by interest-based advertising? Are you for or against it, considering as somebody who gets advertised at? You're for it.
Sort of.
I'm unambiguously for it. If people are going to interrupt my dinner, I'd like them to be trying to sell me something I want to buy.
Yeah.
Right? And when people call me up to try to get me to refinance the mortgage I don't have, it's a waste of my time and their time. But anyway, why would people be against it? But interest-based advertising basically means people want to figure out who is a likely customer for what they're selling, not waste their time advertising to people who aren't likely customers. So if you think about the online, which is the easiest, the best place to do it, as it were, you can imagine setting things up so that I am buying the right to put a certain number of ads on your web page. But the software, when you log onto the web page, looks up some kind of information about you to decide whether to put my ad, which is for computer games because you happen to be somebody who plays computer games, or your ad, which is for exercise equipment because the information says I'm the kind of person who buys exercise, or your ad, and it then shows the ad according to what they think the customer is. So, I don't see anything bad about that, but some people clearly do, so can somebody tell me what's bad about it?
Primarily from personal stories, the stories that I've heard that, for instance, I was shopping for a Christmas gift for my boyfriend, and I was Googling stuff, and then he came on my computer and saw all these advertisements for things related to what I was looking at, and he said, "Oh, it looks like you're buying me, shunned knives, thanks." And
those were not the advertisements that you had actually, those were not web pages selling those things. Those were ads appearing on the web pages.
Just he kind of came to my computer afterwards, and they were.
Congratulations, you have a smart boyfriend.
And so the second time I had this happen, I started doing searches to fake it out for stuff that, like PlayStation and stuff, to try to cover my tracks. Yeah, and
it seems that you're telling me that they've added a new game.
Played
between boyfriends and girlfriends and husbands and wives and parents and children.
Yeah, so I don't know. And then I've heard on a separate note something happened with somebody who was looking at engagement rings, and it populated over, onto his. I guess now I don't go on Facebook a lot, but I guess they do advertisements on the side.
So somebody
saw on the wall or something that he was getting advertisements for engagement rings, and of course everybody on Facebook knew what's up. Oh, Johnny so and so popping the question.
Right.
So of course that clearly.
Interesting.
All right. That's just personal.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It's a legitimate point that you have it. That as long as I'm the only one who's seeing the ads, then it's only telling me things I already know. But you could imagine cases where that transmits information about my behavior not to the people who want to sell me stuff, but to other people who might want to keep it secret.
Yeah, which is exactly what the issue's pointing at, that eventually it's getting in some storage database, and it's fine if something really harmless, but if the government sees you're looking to buy
I'm not sure I quite count your boyfriend as a database.
Oh, okay, well.
But I agree. That's an interesting point. So, What would be, but it's interesting, the question is what unwanted or deceitful exploitation of information from private or public institutions? And you can certainly see that you might worry about it from public institutions, because public institutions can transact with you without your consent. So that's, there you could imagine that if you have unpopular political views, the FBI will know that you're the one whose phone they should be debugging and things like that. Yep.
So like another private advocacy is that some people argue that narrows your horizon, so like you will only see things that you only explore, you won't be exposed to new things. And actually, a major criticism of Google's search results is that if you first log into Google or Gmail or something, it will have all your information in a database, and based on where you're located, what you email, whatever, your search results will be based off of that. Mm-hmm. So a search result I do will not be the same as something you will do.
Right.
So that actually is...
Why is that a bad thing?
Because when you want to find... if I'm sitting down here, I want to find information that I don't know already.
Yes.
Google will be actually narrowing it down to things that will, that's already within the realm of what
but I want. But what it's trying to do, at least, is not to find things you know, but to find the things you want to know.
But it's finding things based on what I already know. But say I have some information that... I have a new interest in 1920s cars, but none of my old.
But your search, won't your search string tell them that?
It'll be too linked to. I already. Yeah. I want to be totally. I want to be exposed to something I've never been exposed to before, and that's limited by this narrow.
All right. Part of the question I would put is for somebody who makes that argument, is that person in favor of advertising in general? Would he say that he would, because the argument implies that advertising provides a net benefit in giving you free information, yet most people, in my experience, regard advertising as a nuisance you put up with. So I would say anybody who's got his TV recording system set up to fast forward over the ads probably can't make that argument with a good conscience, because he's deliberately trying not to be exposed to stuff. And if I had a TV fast forwarding thing, I would definitely have it go over the ads too. Yep.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Apple advertising seem like one of those necessary evils, and they do pay for lots of things that I enjoy, such as television.
Yep.
And so if companies know that we're just fast forwarding through the ads, and they have to find another efficient way to get the information to us, so I kind of feel like it's a small price to pay.
But I guess my feeling is, not ad versus non-ad, but targeted versus non-targeted, then on average it seems to me the targeted are an improvement, because there are so many things in the world I'm not interested in, and therefore a random selection is going to... Whereas there are things I like getting, and I think the way I put it in the book somewhere, I was thinking of an older technology, which is gadget catalogs, that it's pretty clear that what mail-order catalogs you get sent to you, which I guess are a little less common than they used to be with the web, but they're still around, is not random. And that it used to be the... I'm not sure if I get as many gadgets. I used to get gadget catalogs. I think the reason was that somebody had a record of my buying some gadget or other, or buying from a place that sold gadgets, what Edmund Scientific used to be, one of the standard places that sold weird, neat things. And on the whole, I sort of enjoyed those catalogs. All right, let me go on to the... next one. Shall private companies that develop increasingly invasive surveillance procedures be allowed to accept government subsidies in exchange for their agreement to allow government agencies to access data accumulated by the product? Will the acceptance of such funds from the government be a violation of the Fourth Amendment's right of the people to be secure in their persons, homes, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures? That struck me as a very interesting question. Because we're used to sort of thinking of, are you or aren't you searched, did they get into your house and so forth. And yet a lot of these technologies, true of some of the later questions too, are sort of blurring the line between looking at what's out there and searching you, as it were. So any comments, people's reaction on that? Yep.
So actually getting funds from, I'm not sure so clear about the lobbying, but I think if you get the funds from the government, then you can actually raise government state action. I think that's the government.
That's
otherwise,
right.
If Google is forced to give it to the government, that's not state action. Action search would not be state action.
Yes.
But having government funded, that would cost us.
That's right. And then the question is, I think, though maybe I'm wrong, that really this would be the same question as if the FBI was doing this in themselves.
Yeah.
That is, given, assuming they can, assuming that the information is public information in the sense that when you browse the web and you look at a particular web page, the fact that you looked at that web page is public information from the standpoint of the proprietor of the web page. I mean, he knows that. So suppose the U.S. government decided out of the kindness of its heart to set up a bunch of really useful web pages, you know, things like MapQuest or Google Maps or that sort of thing, utilities that many people would use. But also, along with that, there were also things like library catalogs. And those were U.S. government things. And they monitored who looked at what on them. And deliberately used that to look for people who were looking for bomb-making supply books or subversive ideas or whatever things they were worried about. Would that count as a search?
No, because you are... There's an understanding that if you go on the website, they're giving out information. So that is... The expectation of privacy is not there.
So the next question is, suppose they do exactly the same things, except they do it through front companies. So imagine that the U.S. government sets up companies, as one is told the CIA sometimes does, which in fact are not really companies. They're really the relevant government agency. But what they tell people is this is a company which sells the service of browsing libraries, or this is a company which sells various sorts of information access. Suppose we discovered to our astonishment that Google was really a CIA front company, in which case we solved the deficit problem because now Google's revenues all go into the treasury. But at that point, is it a search? In other words, you know that you're revealing the information to the proprietor of the page, but you don't know that the proprietor of the page is the CIA. And what counts as privacy? Is it privacy? I think I have actually in the book, I think I've got the quote from Habermas about, you know, safe to tell something to one, you can tell it to two, three, everybody knows it. And Habermas is, what, 9th century or so? So it's an old idea. So the question is, do I still have an expectation of privacy if I have revealed the information to somebody? I don't know that somebody is the U.S. government, but that somebody has not promised, not made any privacy promises. Is that an expectation of privacy? Anybody know? Yes, I don't. Yeah?
I say yes.
You think yes?
Yes. Because they didn't have any suspicion to target you, to get the information from you, they can't just wait around for information to come.
Supposedly in East Germany, something like half the population were working for the secret police part-time. So suppose it turns out that the friend who you like gossiping with at the bar is a part-time FBI informer. Is that violating your expectation of privacy? Anyone know it? They do use informers, after all.
That's different than them already having information. That's them having information that I do something, not proof that I do something.
Yeah, but that's a case in which they have the information that you said something to somebody, just as in the case we're discussing, they have the information that you told a web page something about yourself, namely, I want to read this on your web page.
Yeah, the difference between the conversation and the internet is that the conversation is, okay, now, based on this information that this person said this, we can go look at them and follow them and inspect them, versus going to a web page and access information is like, oh, we already got you. We don't need to do anything else.
Well, they're really using it in order to find suspicious people who are then going to gather more information about, right? That is, I don't, except for child porn, I'm not sure I can think of anything you can do on the web reading that's illegal, right? Posting, you can do slander and libel and such, and copyright violation. But as far as I can tell, the only thing it's illegal to do in terms of reading is read child porn. And so in that case, they can't get you for what you read. All they can do is spot you for what you read and then realize that further investigation might determine that you are an evil person of some sort. Other comments, questions? Because I really don't know where it would come in. And it's going to, there are more questions on, more issues here, which really touch on the same general question of what counts as a search in a world where things are very different. And And it was sort of, it isn't the same issue, but a point worth repeating, which I got years ago from someone I know, is the idea that what limited wiretaps in the past was not really the legal restriction at all, but how costly it was. So if you think about what has technology changed, if technology reduces the cost of wiretapping somebody from $1,000 a month to 50 cents a month, that's not a legal change, and yet it's a very important change in how concerned you ought to be about wiretapping, right? And similarly here, if they could always have stood at the door of stores and see who goes in and out, and maybe if they could recognize people, say, aha, that person is going into a store that sells spying equipment, which stores, some stores sell, therefore he's probably a Russian spy who wants to, you know, spy on our secrets, therefore they could always have done that. And it's the part, it seems to me, what makes these cases interesting is that they can now do it for a tenth of a cent per try instead of for a dollar a try or whatever it counts. If the world becomes more and more transparent, what additional technologies or techniques will people invent to keep certain areas of their life truly private? So you, for example, have the problem of how you make sure that your boyfriend isn't spying on you while you're shopping for him via the surveillance system that Brynn has now gotten us to install. So that's interesting. Let's take that case for a moment. Suppose I want to shop for my wife, and I want it to be a surprise for her. And imagine a world where the inside of our houses is still private, but all public spaces, including all stores, are public. And I suspect that my wife wants to know what I'm getting and therefore is going to try to defeat my attempts. What's the obvious solution? How do I do my shopping when that situation exists?
Online, have it delivered.
Online, exactly, precisely. I shift to online because I can do the same thing online, look at, you know, things for sale, but now there are no cameras watching. All right? So that's one answer to the question, it seems to me, is that in the world, if we imagine a world where there are certain areas that are public and certain ones that are private, that part of the way you alter your behavior is to shift anything you want to keep secret out of the public areas into the private ones. Yep.
Also, like pirate browsing and Google's incognito. So if you're at your guest's house, someone else's house, you can just not affect their interaction with them, their cameras. You can just open incognito window. And everything you do
will be anonymous. Yes. This question was put in terms of surveillance, not of the web. I mean, they're both showing up in these issues. But I was thinking in the case of physical surveillance. And we've discussed a little bit earlier ways in which, with regard to web surveillance, you could hide stuff. But you could think of this as, it's not just shopping for your wife's secret present. It's also gossiping. It's also giving your real opinion of your boss to a coworker. It's also maybe flirting with a woman who your girlfriend doesn't know you're flirting with, or your wife doesn't know you're flirting with. You could think of a whole lot of activities which you could still conduct in that world, but you would be much more selective about where you conducted them. Right? Does that make sense? And then the next step is, let's suppose we've got the video mosquitoes and the inside of your house is also public space. Now what do you do? How do you talk about your feelings of your boss to the coworker who's a good friend?
Go to a bar.
Bar's probably got a video mosquito too. Oh, you figure it's noisy?
Put on a disguise.
That would be. I don't know if the disguise is going to work, because somebody who wants to can just trace you back to when you take off the disguise, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a different world if you imagine the sort of full scale thing that Brynn is talking about. What's the other way? It seems to me that you're missing a different and very common tactic, which is basically coded language. That if you know you and your coworker know each other pretty well, and your boss probably doesn't know well, you've read some of the same books, and you could say, you know, he's a really able boss. He reminds me of Ellsworth Toohey, which for any Rand fans is not exactly a positive reference. And you could think of other cases where you could say things depending on shared jargon, shared slang, shared experience. You could say, he reminds me of so-and-so in school who we both went to school with. And you could do it in such a way that an observer wouldn't know it was a positive or negative reference, but your friend would know that that was somebody who was a real pain. Or so-and-so, a teacher we had in high school, or so-and-so, a teacher we had in law school, and it could be positive or negative. So my point is only that one approach, if there are private places, is to do your talking or whatever else you're doing in private places, and the other approach is to try to do it in the human equivalent of encryption, that is, in forms that are not transparent. Or it doesn't have to be something the boss couldn't find. It only has to be like it's costly for the boss to find something because the boss has got limited resources of time and effort, too. So it may be sufficient that you do something so you have to go to some trouble. Yep.
Are you assuming that the boss is the one operating Mosquito?
No. I'm assuming for a moment Brin's picture in which the surveillance network's open to everybody. One of the things we have to think about as we go on in this discussion is three different versions of the picture. One of them is the version Brin at least says he wants, where it's presumably a government-run network, but it's open to everybody. That's the transparent society. The second is the one where it's a government-run network and the government gets to decide who sees what. And the third is the one in which it is a private network. A bunch of private networks. Maybe it's not a network at all. It could just be anybody can spy on what he wants by having a half a dozen video mosquitoes. But most of the things I don't know. But the limiting version of that is what I think of as the open source version of the transparent society, where there is some mechanism by which all the video mosquitoes, in effect, pool their information and make it available to all of their owners. And that would be sort of, in a sense, one... I mean, it's worth seeing, I think, that you've really got a bunch of different cases, all of which go under this sort of... Let me put it down on the board that most of you don't bother to do. One is Brin. The other is Brin minus transparency, meaning the network is there, but the people running it decide who gets to see what. The third is, I guess, what I think of as maybe private, uncoordinated, where you never know whether anybody's spying on you, but you know that any particular person probably isn't because it's a big world. And then the fourth is what I think of as open source transparency. I think it's sort of worth, while we're going through these things, seeing that those are all somewhat different situations, any of which could come out of this technology. So the private uncoordinated is the one where you can never be sure that somebody isn't watching, but in fact you know it is very unlikely that any particular person is watching at any given time, because each particular person has too many things he'd like to see. Whereas the open source transparency is like, four is like one, except that it's done by a mechanism which makes two impossible, if that makes sense. All right? Because now there is nobody in control. Now, all of these, I should say, there's a further dimension that I'm ignoring, I think, for today, but you ought to keep in the back of your mind, is can you trust the information? That is to say, in the open source model, maybe I can pour in false information into that network, and the more I can do that, the less you really have transparency, because the less you're sure what's true. And so that's going to be a further issue in a lot of this stuff. All right. So those are all possible ways. And for a moment, let's suppose that none of real space is private. Assume the video mosquitoes are everywhere and it's a complete system, but assume we can still control the interface between real space and cyberspace. So we've got a mind to machine, or we're typing under a hood in some way that's... So what I think of it as is most interesting, just because of the tension, is transparent society in real space, strong privacy in cyberspace. And in that world, if you want privacy, you do it in cyberspace. That's a world which pushes you towards more use of virtual reality. And in fact, in a way, in the extreme case where there's really good VR for everybody, we don't care about what they're watching in real space. There's nothing happening in real space. In the more realistic case, some of what you do can be done online and in private, and some of it can't be. All right. Currently, a restraining order may be granted not only to prevent physical abuse, but also to prevent verbal abuse, stalking, and other threatening behaviors. Will restraining orders cover small cameras used to track every movement by the victim as a form of stalking and harassment, or will they be allowed because the victim no longer has the expectation of privacy? Before we answer the legal question, aren't we going to have to answer the technical question, is it possible to restrain? All right, because again, think of our different models. In model one, the answer is, sorry, bud, we've got this thing set up so that nobody can control what anybody else sees. And your reason for setting it up that way? Well, we want to make sure that the police don't make sure we don't watch them when they're doing bad things. All right? So model two is the one where this becomes a serious issue, because you could imagine, if you're more optimistic about governments than I am, you could imagine a system where we say, well, we've got a system that watches everything, but we've got responsible people in charge of it, and the default is that everybody can see everything. But if you can come with a good legal reason, such as the fact that this person who's harassing me wants to watch me in the shower, and I want to make sure that nobody can watch me in the shower, then we will, in effect, turn off the camera to that person when it's watching you in the shower. All right, so you could imagine versions of number two in which there are legal mechanisms by which people can restrict. And as we're thinking about sort of what would be sensible rules, you could have one limit. You could say, well, the rule is that anybody can choose not to have itself show up on the camera for anyone. So we now say we can opt out of the transparent society. And, of course, the obvious problem is that the person who really wants to opt out of the transparent society is the mugger, burglar, the person who the transparent society is partly designed to catch. All right? Can you think of any other good rules? Suppose, imagine for a moment, I'm very distrustful of government. Suppose I'm not. Suppose we imagine that we've got a government, we think it's benevolent, it's intelligent, it's competent. What should the rules be about who can see what? Anybody?
I don't understand. Is this question supposed to match up with this stalking thing, or is this just a
the stalking thing is just leading?
The
stalking thing is suggesting one possible rule, right? Okay. That you can get an order saying so and so is not allowed to. Is not allowed to might mean that he can be arrested if it turns out his video mosquito was in your house, but it could also mean that the centralized system won't let him see it. That's where I was getting to. So do people have? All right, so imagine we're living in that world. We have a government we can trust. What rules would you like to have about how people can control who can see what about them? Anybody?
Maybe like for you yourself to set up a radius. Like, if I don't want anyone to see me at all.
Within a certain
radius.
So one possibility is that you can decide whether your house is private. Right? So in that one, we're back with the pure transparent society for public places, but now we're having sharp public-private division, which is something a lot of people have an intuition for, right? You say, well, of course, if you decide to walk down Main Street stark naked, you got no one to complain to but yourself. Maybe other people got something to complain to. But you ought to be able to wander around inside your house with the blinds closed stark naked if you feel like it. I think a lot of people sort of that seems right to them. So, and not only can nobody complain, but you ought to know that nobody is watching. You ought to be able to know. So that's one possibility. You could imagine a regime in which one of the things you own, and which part of ownership in a sense, is which are the areas that you can ban surveillance in. It's an interesting idea. And you can even imagine a market for that. You can imagine a system in which, hey, this is a new way for the government to raise taxes, all right? To raise revenue, not taxes. No, I bought taxes. They auction off the airwaves now. So we're now going to auction off the surface of the earth. And the form of it is very simple. Whoever bids the largest amount for the right to have this little square not visible to surveillance cameras gets that right.
That's so wrong.
So poor people don't get
privacy. So poor people don't get any privacy?
Well, they don't get very much privacy. Poor people, after all, probably have smaller houses. They don't have to buy as much privacy to keep their house in private. You don't like that solution.
I don't.
Well, if we want to be more egalitarian, fine. We allocate to everybody. Everyone starts with the right to have 100 square feet private. Some amount private. But they can trade.
Like a cap and trade.
Like a cap and trade system.
Right. See, it still favors the rich person.
Well,
they can buy more space.
But he's buying it from the poor person. So the poor person is getting an equalizing of income at the cost of getting of trading it. Right? Do you really want to say in general that it hurts poor people to allow them to sell things?
No. I just think that perhaps if they need that money for vital,
but if they need that, in that case, if you don't allow them to sell things, they won't get those vital necessary things.
So, I think we banned this inhumane, like you can't just sell your organ, right?
It's the same argument.
Maybe.
You're assuming there's a good reason not for people to sell organs. Right, that's when we may come to later. I mean, that's it's an interesting, because it's the same. There's the problem with the he had to do it argument is if you really take it seriously, that means that if he doesn't do it, terrible things happen to him. Then you forbid him from doing it, and terrible things happen to him. There's sort of in the background somehow the assumption that someone else will save him from the terrible things.
It also favors couples and families with multiple living in the same house.
It favors people who, for whatever reason, yes, that's an interesting point. Though, of course, it doesn't have to be a couple or family. It could also be you and your best friend, where you say, I don't care if he sees what I'm doing. He doesn't care if I see what I'm doing. So, therefore, we will jointly. Yeah. But, anyway, all right, I don't know that I have any good answers. It just struck me as an interesting question. If you imagine a system where you could control what can or can't be seen, are there any obvious rules for how you do it? And I can see the one obvious rule, which says that everybody with regard to his own, I don't even want to say property, because I want to include rented apartments as well, but with regard to those places where you can forbid trespassers, put it that way, that treat it as looking at you as a trespass, so therefore you could imagine a system where with regard to any area where you could forbid trespassers, you could also forbid the video from seeing it. Alright, so that's I think a not absurd way you could imagine version 2 being done, assuming you aren't too worried that if they've got the technology to do it, they will also use it so when they're torturing dissidents, that's off camera too.
How do they do it today? Today they have obviously cameras on public streets, which seems to make some sense.
That's mostly in England, much less here. Yeah.
I don't know if there would be a problem. I don't think there'd be a lot of uproar. The little shop spot cameras that are on if you like run a red light, if they just have those rolling all the time.
Yes.
And then they have the gun thing that records the gunshots.
Microphone.
And then now they have cameras attached to law enforcement. So, I mean, to some degree, the concept of surveillance in certain spaces is already...
Yes, but I think Brin suggests that if it's not... But it's not a transparent society, because you don't get to listen to those microphones and see what's coming out of those cameras. And... So that what you have at the moment, I mean, it still might be troubling. You might be worried that, for example, the red light cameras could be used by the FBI to know where you go all the time. And maybe we aren't sure we want the FBI to have that power. That after all, if they know where you go all the time, if you have politically unpopular views and you're also cheating on your wife, then they tell your wife about it as a way of punishing you for your unpopular views. I mean, that's more or less the Martin Luther King story, as far as I can tell.
It is transparent to some degree, because I can't imagine under some sort of like public records act that you can't access.
You could imagine making it so. I think in terms of what now exists, though, I don't even know if they have a recording of the gunshot thing service. Just that when it happens, it notifies them.
Okay.
Right. You'd have to be record in order for somebody to be able to use some method to get access to it. It's got to be there, and that requires recording. So. But you can certainly imagine what I think is happening in England, maybe to some extent here, and it's certainly happening inside stores here where you've got cameras to prevent shoplifting and such. You could certainly imagine that there are a bunch of places, let us say stores and public places, where there are video cameras rolling all the time. And that still is of somewhat limited use if you don't have a way of finding things. But then the next step is we have face recognition software, so whoever is pooling the information has a database which says if you want to know where she was at 1 p.m., here's the cameras whose feed you ought to be looking at, kind of thing. So that would be sort of a gradual evolution from what we have in the direction of what Brin is describing, but it's still not what he wants. And set up so everybody can access the information, which is part of what's striking about what he's doing. Notice, by the way, that there is another, I should have mentioned, another possibility of that particular question, and that is you could say, we aren't going to keep the stalker from watching you. What we're going to do is to record who he watches, and now we can have him punished for violating the court order when our records show that he was watching you when he was forbidden for doing so. That's, after all, the way we do it now, right? We don't, if you have an injunction saying you can't get within 200 yards of so-and-so's house because of one of these cases, that doesn't mean that someone is actually physically holding you away from the house. It just means that if they spot you within that distance, they'll call you back into court and fine you or jail you or do whatever they're doing to enforce the injunction. So you could imagine a version of that, but do you see the downside of that? Right? The downside of the one where they don't let you see is that means somebody's controlling who can see what, and we're worried about the fact that the controllers will use that for their own purposes. And can you see the mirror image issue if it is set up so they know who is watching what? We're then back with the discussion we were discussing before, except now it's the government which has got all of that information, and it's much more information than we get from watching who you're, how you're browsing.
All right. People are... Let
me stop just for a moment, because my guess is we're not going to reach the end of this fairly long collection of things. Are there ones here that struck people here as particularly interesting that you would like to discuss before I just go on doing it in sequence? And you might think, by the way, for future weeks, given that we may be in this situation again, that when you look at the issues prior to class, if that's the point of putting them up on the web, that you might notice there's one you particularly want to talk about, and then push for talking about that one if we aren't going to have enough time to talk about all of them. Would a future significant loss of privacy have a chilling effect on speech? Surely it could. Would the anticipation of a chilling effect on speech make for a good legal argument to maintain a high standard of privacy?
Why do you say it would have a chilling effect on speech? I don't,
The argument is that I will be reluctant to say what I really think of, let us say, the governor of California, if I suspect that people working for him are listening. Imagine, think about the fact that at the moment, probably in most of the U.S., if your local government doesn't like you, you're going to have problems. My wife tells a story, which has nothing to do with anybody not liking anybody, but it illustrates it. When we were living in Chicago, our house was in a fairly old part of the city, which had gotten somehow classified as of historical interest or something. Our fence was falling down, and we wanted to have it replaced with an identical fence. It took her 2 days, holding in her arms an infant, to get through the paperwork to get permission to replace our fence with an identical fence. Think about how long it would have taken if for some reason the relevant officials that had her list had reacted her name as, oh, that troublemaker. All right. On the other hand, I also remember in this area, a long time ago, our kids were going to a small and very unconventional private school, and the parents were looking at the possibility of buying a permanent building for the school as opposed to renting, which is what we were doing. And at one point, I talked to people about a particular piece of land which looked suitable, sort of investigating the possibilities. And what I was told was a good deal of the market value of this land consists of the fact that it already has planning permission for the construction that the person owning it is planning to do. How do you get planning permission? Well, Mr. Jones, who is one of the, I don't know, has some role in the city government, whichever city in this area it was in, owns this area. Basically, the way you get planning permission is to persuade him that he would like to have you build what you want to build here. All right. I gather that's a very common situation in practice, and it's hard to avoid once you've given, and you can avoid it by having much less regulation of all sorts, but given a regulatory system, it's not like you can have extensive objective ways for every single decision, so in practice a lot's going to depend on whether the official making the decision likes you or doesn't like you, and I think that's true. We think of that as being true in third world countries, but I suspect it's true in almost any society, at least for a fair number of things. Well, there's your chilling effect on speech. Do you really want to be on the list of people who your local officials regard as the kind of person we don't really want in our neighborhood anyway? So that's a chilling effect on speech, all right? Now you can all... Yep.
But that assumes that most speech that makes someone unlikable is done in private, or done not in their own name, or done not in public.
Is currently, you mean?
Yes. Which I think most people who the city government doesn't like know who they are, because they don't care.
Well, I'm wondering about that, because there's... I want to go back to the point that I make in the book about why cities used to be private. Privacy through obscurity. And the point is that one of the effects of the technological change is to weaken that. So if you imagine, at the moment, my guess is that even if I proclaim on my website that I'm an anarchist, it is rather unlikely that the official who I ask for permission to fix my fence is going to know that fact. On the other hand, it doesn't take very, very much projection into the future to imagine a situation where routinely the city government has web spiders, which are basically trying to find out everything they can about everybody in that particular city. Useful information. After all, he might be somebody we could use. He might be helpful for something. He might be the person who can give us advice on some subject. And he might be somebody we'd like to know who we really don't like having around. So it seems to me that even if we separate the two effects, one of them is surveillance, one of them is databases, basically. And then what I suggest in the chapter is the combination of those, of surveillance databases and face recognition, is sort of what I at least think of as the dangerous combination. And so here, you could imagine, any link could do it. You could say, fine, forget about surveillance. We're not going to allow governments to use databases. But that seems to run into a lot of problems, because databases are very useful things to use. But the real question is, isn't there a problem that if people who can impose costs on you, and it doesn't have to be limited to government, of course, it could be your boss too, know too easily what you're doing and saying, that raises, among other things, a chilling effect on speech. Yeah?
This would be really hard, I think, to implement, but I could imagine that you could bring suit with some sort of penalty, like when I think of retaliatory eviction, that,
yes,
you know, a tenant is saying something and then the presumption immediately goes against the other person that they evicted or they didn't build your fence, and has some sort of civil penalty.
You could imagine doing that. On the other hand, the more that is, in a sense, you're adding more and more friction, because that means that every time an official does something, he's got to make sure he's got a paper trail so he can prove he had a good reason, even if he really did have a good reason.
Yeah.
So you can imagine mechanisms of that sort, but they're also likely to be sort of costly mechanisms in other ways. Let me think about it as a legal question, because that you can probably know more about than I do. Suppose it is true that allowing a certain technology to develop will have a chilling effect on speech. Does that by itself provide a justification for blocking the technology? I'm not talking about the government doing something. All right? Imagine that the government, there are ways the government could prevent a technology, could tax the technology. Suppose we say that this technology has a chilling effect on speech, and I therefore want the court to require the government to tax it. Is that illegally? Do I have any chance at all of prevailing in court? I don't think so. Suppose, let me take an analogous old technology case. Suppose we observe that the press is not very lively, and it turns out the reason is that printing has gotten really expensive for some reason. Hard to believe that I can go to court and say the government is constitutionally required to subsidize printing presses. And yet that seems to me would be the equivalent of that. But anyway, let's keep going. But I'm going to skip the FCC one. Next one is one which I think is sort of interesting. In a transparent society, how does an inventor prove that he has satisfied the first to invent requirement of U.S. patent law while the U.S. has first to invent, which I gather somebody said last time is going out now. What difficulties would arise under the alternative first to submit rule? Does transparency increase the relative advantage of one system over the other? So we've got a full transparent society. Everybody can see what everybody else is doing. No private areas, including workshops and labs and so forth. Which of the two methods is hurt more by that?
First to submit the same as first to file?
Those are the two.
Okay.
That's it. First to submit versus first to invent.
Okay.
Is it clear what in that world you do in a first to invent world? How do I make sure that I can prove first to invent? I keep records that I can prove. All right. I have video cameras running all the time. Or for that matter, I don't even have to do it because after all, the government's videoing everything and recording it. So in principle, all I have to do will be the first to invent thing. And then, all right, here is the archive of everything that's happened in the last 5 years in America. Let's follow that claimant back and see when he started working on this project. Let's follow me back. Look, I started working on this project a month before he did. All right, so in principle, at least, I'm not sure how practical. You can imagine arguing that it's going to make it easier to prove first to invent. And even if you can't do it that way, you can say, all right, every day I'm going to photograph my notebook. I'm going to have I'm going to keep those photographs, and I'm going to have a hash made of those of that information and publish that hash in the newspaper every day, so I can prove that it existed at that time, which is how you, that's digital time stamping. All right, make sense?
It would probably lead to tons of litigation, because if everybody can see what you're doing, somebody else might have been working on the project but not as fast or not keeping notes.
So you
step in and said, oh, I see Joe Schmo over there.
But if he hasn't kept notes, he's sunk, because he's not going to be a way of proving first to invent, just as he isn't now. Yeah.
Okay, and in this hypothetical world, it almost makes the value of patent irrelevant, and increases the value of trade secrets. So having
trade secrets are going to be impossible.
But then remember we had a hypothetical which you could actually purchase, you know, buy those
things. Oh, in that case.
So that would make that. I mean, in this world,
now trade secrets are doable again.
The point of the patent is to, you know, make it patently obvious whatever you're doing, right? So that, you know, monopoly. But if that's happening from the get-go, there's no incentive for you to, you know.
But the other argument for patent is to give you an incentive to invent, right?
But
I want to go back to my question. What happens to the first to file in this system? We have a transparent society and no private areas at all for a moment. What happens to the European system?
Seven shops close to the patent office.
That's one thing you might do. Or at least you move your shop as close to the patent office when you're getting close to the critical point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think real estate, you know how in Manhattan there's actually real estate that's a lot closer to the internet?
I didn't.
High-speed trading.
Uh-huh.
For e-filing, but probably make it.
Right.
To a patent.
But I was thinking not of that so much, but of the fact that you now have a very high incentive to submit, to file as early as possible, which is going to mean filing at a point when it's not that you can get the patent because you haven't done enough work. Right. Both, you're going to have a race, but the race is a race for, I'm watching you, you're watching me, we got no secrets. All we can do is to decide when we file. Well, if you're going to file tomorrow, I'm going to file today. If I'm going to file today, you're going to file yesterday. All right? So the point I'm getting to, which is part of why I find this question an amusing one, is maybe the U.S. has abandoned first to invent just as it became the best system. Just as I like to argue that the European Union solved the problems of multiple currencies, only now it turns out maybe they haven't, just as it became unnecessary to solve them, because you do everything with credit cards and the computers convert money transparently and so forth. But anyway, all right. What impact will total transparency have on our interaction with our families? Would parents be afraid to punish their children because of the chance that evidence would be used against them in a child custody dispute sometime down the future? And if so, how much of that evidence would we allow in court in the first place? Will there be a shift to what we currently admit as evidence? I thought that was an interesting question.
Well, just because we discover something or we know something doesn't have to be entered as evidence, so it should be allowed in evidence.
Doesn't have to be allowed.
Yeah, today we know a lot of things, but not everything can make it.
So then the question is, if we've got this world, what can the parties to a suit, whether government or private parties, what are they or are they not allowed to restrict? What are the restrictions on what surveillance data they can use? Isn't it perfectly reasonable for me to say, look, we've got videos of how my about-to-be ex-wife treated our kids for the last 10 years, I'm going to go through, find points which demonstrate what a terrible job she did of being a mother, and then show them to the jury. Isn't that legitimate?
Yeah.
At the risk that she'll do the same thing to me, of course.
Well, of course, you can make them show the rest of it, too.
The what?
So now you, of course, you want to focus it on the bad part so the court can force you to show the whole thing?
I can't. The whole thing is a 10-year long.
But the summary of that book, you may not be doing the whole thing,
there's the problem. See, you're getting at the right problem. I'm just not sure I know what the solution is. Because the problem is that if you've got all this video, you're going to necessarily show a selected tiny, tiny subset of the jury. And unless the jury is very clever, that's going to be misleading. Because whatever point you're trying to make, yes, my ex-wife lost her temper 3 times in 10 years. That is not very good evidence of being a bad mother. But if all you see are those 3 incidents, then it looks terrible. So I was thinking about sort of, can you think of any rules of evidence that would still let you use this valuable information but somehow avoid that? The first idea that occurred to me, but I think it's probably a nutty idea, is to say that each side can introduce X number of hours and the other side can choose to black out a quarter of it. So you can if you think that the jury is actually willing to watch 3 hours of tape, you pick the worst 4 hours. And I get to wipe out the worst hour of that 4 hours. So that would be an attempt to sort of balance the selection. I don't think it's a very good one, but it's sort of suggesting a direction you might imagine if you want to imagine how you could change the rules of what's admissible to try to avoid this sort of a problem.
I can imagine a lot of hearsay problems as well. People saying stuff on the tape and then you have to mute it out. And if they're, I don't think we still have that evidence rule that people's actions can be counted as hearsay. So, the person putting up the umbrella is offered to prove that it was raining. I don't think that is hearsay. But I can imagine bringing back a rule like that, where you could look at people's conduct and then decide that their conduct is hearsay, and then whatever video clip you were offering might just get so patchy it would become a terrible
hearsay. Might be. Now, the other problem that the person who submitted the question was introducing is whether it have a bad or a good effect, though I don't think you raised that, about how we treat the kids. The answer might be, well, most of the time you're married, you're not thinking about getting divorced, so the issue isn't going to arise. But if you imagine that people are sort of sensitive to the fact that the marriage might break down, if you imagine the kind of marriage which is sort of shaky for a long period of time, it hasn't actually broken down, you could then say, I really ought to speak sternly to our kid, but if I do, it's going to be on the tape and you're going to use it if you ever have a problem. I'm actually reminded about something. I've written a couple of novels. One of them was commercially published and one wasn't. But I have one scene I sort of like in one of them where you've got a very high status man who's a widower and he's talking to his 10-year-old son about various women who have been visiting. This is a more or less medievalish kind of society, and the son says, "I like so and so best. She doesn't bring me candy." And it's clear that the son realizes that the other women want him to pressure his father to marry them, and that the one who treats him like a human being, he explains, "She's telling me about magic. This is a fantasy world, and I'm teaching her chess." And in that sense, you can see that how you treat kids could get very touchy if you're trying to not just do a good job of being a parent, but to manipulate something else, as it were.
Yep. Then it's also so subjective, because if you're not punching your kid because you want to look good, you're going to look like a bad parent because you're not punching your kid when it's wrong.
Yes, you're going to have the further problem that the jury will have a wide range of potential different views on child rearing, and one of them is going to say, you're a softy, clearly incompetent, and another one is saying, look, you're mistreating your kids, clearly incompetent, and that's going to be a further problem. But incidentally, this question doesn't mention what to me is the much more chilling concern, which is not divorce, but Child Protective Services deciding you're an unsuited parent and therefore they should take your kids away. I followed in some detail the FLDS case in Texas. I don't know how many of you did, but where basically the Texas child protective people took, I think, 300 children away from their parents, ultimately on the basis of a bogus phone call, which they had to have known was a bogus phone call within a couple of weeks, because by that time it was in a British newspaper, the identity of who made that phone call. But the people they were taking away from were people the Child Protective Service disapproved of, because they were fundamentalist LDS types, and it took a unanimous decision of the Texas Appeals Court followed by unanimous decision of the Texas Supreme Court to make them give the kids back to their parents. So that scares me. I mean, it doesn't scare me anymore because my kids are now adults, more or less, but it scares me to imagine a case in which somebody who disapproved of some part of my life might conclude, therefore, that they should take my kids away. So that's another dimension that you might think about, whether the risks of that. Both the first order risk of having kids taken away shouldn't be, and I would say almost always they shouldn't be, because even though some people are terrible parents, they're only rarely as bad parents as what happens to kids who get raised by someone other than their parents, so I think the available evidence. We had a job talk years ago by somebody who had done work. He was, a Cornell law student, had been, and he had done volunteer work with poor people in Ithaca. And a good deal of his work involved interacting with the government agencies that were, among other things, deciding whether they got to keep their kids. And I asked him whether, on net, he thought the world would be better or worse if governments did not have the power to take children away from unsuitable parents. And he said he couldn't speak for the country as a whole, but in the area he was observing, it would be better if they didn't have that power. He thought that on net it did damage. So that's another one. But then there's a second order effect of would it mess up your interaction with your kids if you were afraid that somebody might use it in that way. Let me see what else I want to skip. Yes, this is one of mine, actually. Suppose there is a publicly run system, this is my number two, basically, along the line suggested by Brin, or maybe even number one. Someone proposes programming the system to spot stalkers and peeping toms by looking for patterns in what cameras which person accesses when. Is doing so desirable? Does it raise any legal problems? You might want to consider analogous approaches with current technology and whether they would raise legal problems. So we're imagining that they're going to let everybody look at everything. It's just that they know what you're looking at. And you can certainly see legitimate reasons why you would want to do that. Are there problems with doing that? Is that a search?
Yeah, you can get 100% accurate.
Let's suppose they are. That they don't, of course, know where their eyes were open, but they know that using whatever mechanism people use to access this surveillance system, that you accessed this video at this time and that video at that time and so forth. I gather there was just a case in Canada where some people were sentenced to life for what were asserted, for I presume correctly, I don't know, to be so-called honor killings. And part of the evidence was evidence that somebody in the household, they had no way of knowing who, had been looking on the internet for information on ways of getting away with murder. So that is actually a real case along those lines, much less extreme than the ones we're imagining. And so here's a different question. Nothing to do with it, it just occurs to me because it's in a way related. And that is, there is a book called The Anarchist Cookbook, which is not really about anarchy in any political sense. It's about things like how to blow things up. It is suspected by some people, and I have no idea if it's true, that it's fake. That it was actually produced by some law enforcement agency, and the instructions are bad instructions and are likely to blow yourself up trying. Supposing that were true, would it be illegal? They aren't making you use it. I'll let you think about that, because I don't know the answer. It just struck me as an intriguing question of whether that kind of law enforcement tactic is or is not legal. So what about what is the current issue, however? Because there is a real current issue, fairly current issue, which is analogous to the one I just raised in that question. Heard anybody? I just went up on the web and checked on it. Librarians. Librarians object that under current law enforcement rules for the FBI, the FBI has an unreasonable ability to, in effect, get information on who is reading what books. Well, that's the same issue. Again, I don't know what the exact legal situation is. If someone wants to do legal research on this sort of subject, that would be possible. All right, well, I think we're out of time. I suggest for the future that if there are particular issues that we raise, that you figure out in advance, because I expect, with luck, we'll have more cases where we've got more to talk about than we have time to talk about it, because that means we're getting something useful done, I hope. And I hope that more of our issues next time will be from you people and fewer from my graveyard. But it's a pretty big graveyard, so it's got a lot of things in it.